talking about it, yes. But action speaks louder than words, and that's what it should be. And I just thank our listeners for listening today. I hope they benefited from the program. It just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for being with us, and goodbye.
Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewie, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
Last year, a powerful explosion in Beirut turned life around for thousands of Lebanese. Now, a number of people have decided to build a monument in honor of the victims of the terrible accident. 27 individuals and organizations have pooled their efforts to build a giant 25-meter sculpture at the site of last August's explosion. The artwork is called Gesture and is made out of reclaimed metal debris. It looks like it's handing a flower to the city of Beirut. When completed, Gesture will also have a water and light installation. The project was conceived and designed by Nadim Karam, one of Lebanon's most celebrated artists. South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tipped sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of two baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost 8 of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst the wildfire. She has a baby. There you go. Miracle number 2.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. The massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this, how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful. The Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
You humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalists usually freeze the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue. A vertical forest has transformed the Chinese megacity of Chengdu into a concrete jungle, making the lives of the residents greener. Each unit at the 8-tower complex has a balcony with around 20 types of luxuriant plants and greenery. The green space filters air and noise pollution while creating a spectacular view. The project in the southwestern city was completed in 2018, and all of the 826 apartments were sold out at the time.
I think it's quite good. The air quality is pretty good and much better than my old houses. The air is good when you wake up in the morning, and the green trees are good for us elderly people. They are good for our eyes.
Besides all the benefits, the apartments have a major problem. They have been overrun by plants and invaded by mosquitoes. The issue has forced some of the occupants to move out. Other cities around the world, such as New York and Copenhagen, have also launched similar green housing projects.
The best visited multimedia exhibit in the world known as Van Gogh Live. The experience has opened in Munich after being postponed a number of times due to COVID-19.
Van Gogh is just the most famous artist in the world. He is also a prototype artist. He is the last artist who then tragically dies at the end. His life story was just fascinating, and that's why he is Van Gogh. But of course, his artworks are fascinating.
Featuring some of Van Gogh's best-known works, the exhibition is not only a feast for the eyes, but the senses with music and smells to accompany the colorful projections. The exhibit is supposed to smell like the countryside because of where Van Gogh lived. However, the organizers say visitors cannot really experience the feeling due to wearing masks. Van Gogh Alive, the experience was first presented in Singapore in 2011. Since then, the multimedia exhibit has been seen in 70 cities and has attracted some 6 million visitors. Conservation measures have managed to bring the world's most endangered cat back from the brink of extinction. In 2002, there were less than 100 Iberian lynx left in the wild. The situation prompted officials in Spain and Portugal to save the animal through a captive breeding program. They also tried hard to fight poaching and reintroduce rabbits, the cat's major prey, into the wild. By the end of 2020, there were over 1,100 Iberian lynx living in the two countries, most of them in Spain's southern region of Andalusia.
The main cause of death for wildlife, certainly in the natural environment, is related to human activities, roadkill, poaching, unwanted encounters. So the less interaction they have with humans, the better.
Despite the successful measures, the International Union for Conservation of Nature still lists the animal as endangered. It's estimated that the species will be out of danger only when its population surpasses 3,000. Urban development, hunting, and roadkill are the major reasons of death for wild lynxes these days. Brazilians have come up with a creative idea. to combat population, that is pollution and global warming, repopulating mangroves. The project is aimed at reforesting an area equal to 75 football fields in Guanabara Bay. Organizers hope to make the biggest mangrove garden in a country. Mangroves, which usually grow in tropical regions, are essential to maintaining water quality and clarity. They filter and trap sediments, heavy metals, and other pollutants. Mangrove forests are also able to store 3 to 4 times more carbon than other forests.
Tehran municipality has inaugurated an art garden that puts on display Iran's art and culture. As Youssef Jalali reports, the cultural facility aims to reconnect visitors with Iran's rich past amid increasing preoccupation with modern lives.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believe that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as this large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden, and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption, driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Robert Reich and Edward Helmore. The piece is titled, American Guns Are Flooding into Mexico and Wreaking Havoc. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Even as Republican members of U.S. Congress accuse President Joe Biden of failing to secure the nation's southern border, Mexico is facing a growing problem of securing its northern border. Guns from the United States are pouring into Mexico, arming violent drug gangs. Mexico has tried just about everything to stop the flow of firearms from the north, passing strict gun control laws, imposing stiff penalties on traffickers, and pleading with U.S. authorities to stop the trafficking. But nothing has worked. So now it's doing what any litigious American would do. It's suing. On Wednesday, 4th of August, Mexico announced that it is seeking at least $10 billion in compensation from 11 major U.S. gun manufacturers for the havoc the U.S. guns have wrought south of the border. The lawsuit charges America's gun makers know their products are being trafficked to Mexico and are expressly marketing their weapons to Mexican criminal gangs, designing guns to be easily modified to fire automatically and be readily transferable on the criminal market in Mexico. The deluge of firearms from the United States to Mexico, on average more than 500 every day, is contributing to mayhem there. Killings have become a routine part of the Mexican drug trade. In Mexico's recent midterm election campaign, 30 candidates were gunned down by criminal gangs. In 2019 alone, at least 17,000 homicides in Mexico were linked to trafficked weapons. Yet Mexico's lawsuit is likely to face tough going in the United States, where the easy accessibility of guns is also wreaking havoc, but where gun ownership is considered a constitutional right and gun purchases are skyrocketing. In addition, U.S. gun makers have erected a fortress of legal protections. In 2005, the gun lobby got congressional Republicans to enact the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Firearms Act, banning most lawsuits brought against gun manufacturers from marketing and distributing their products. At a more basic level, American capitalism considers any market to be an opportunity to make a profit. After all, a buck is a buck, or more precisely, 19.98 pesos at today's exchange rate. In the United States, buying and selling are hallmarks of freedom. To prohibit a sale is to intrude on the free market. For another government to bar its consumers from buying American goods is to violate free trade. Alejandro Celorio, a legal advisor to Mexico's foreign ministry, estimates the damage to the Mexican economy caused by traffic guns totals 1.7% to 2% of Mexico's gross domestic product, GDP. What's left unsaid is that Mexico's illicit drug business is also a boon to the Mexican economy, adding billions of dollars each year in foreign sales, mostly to American consumers eager to buy thousands of kilos of methamphetamines, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl each year. Freedom of contract, it's called. We sell them guns that kill them. They sell us drugs that kill us. But this isn't trading goods. It's trading bads. There's death on both sides. The merchants of such death, American gun makers like Glock, Smith & Wesson, Beretta USA, Barrett, Century International Arms, and Colt, Mexican producers of methamphetamines, heroin, and fentanyl, and the wholesalers and traffickers connecting buyers with sellers on both sides of the border are making piles of money. Free market ideologues will argue that as long as everyone is getting what they want, these trades are efficient. Yet vast numbers of people are dying. The U.S. Republicans who protect gun manufacturers and who are criticizing President Joe Biden for failing to secure the southern border from migrants desperate to come to the United States should take note of this tragic irony. The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption, driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border in the United States. It's also enabling the flow of dangerous drugs from Mexico across the border that are killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, many in states and congressional districts represented by those same Republicans. Guns, dangerous drugs, and desperate migrants are inextricably connected. The answer to solving one of these problems lies in responding to all three. Moreover, gun sales, which spiked sharply during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic, have continued to increase in the United States, with first-time buyers making up more than one-fifth of Americans who purchase guns. The development will frustrate and disappoint gun control advocates who point out the huge number of firearms already circulating in American society, as well as a seemingly never-ending cycle of mass shootings. A study by the General Social Survey, a public opinion poll conducted by a research center at the University of Chicago, 39% of American households own guns, up from 32% in 2016. Separately, research data compiled by the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, background checks that topped 1 million a week in March of 2020, the highest since the government began tracking them in 1998, and continued with 1 week in April this year recording a record 1.2 million checks. Background checks are seen as a reliable metric to track gun sales. A third data study, compiled by Northeastern University and the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and seen by the New York Times, shows that 6.5% of American adults, or 17 million people in the United States, have purchased guns in the past year, up from 5.3% in 2019. Of those, almost one-fifth who bought guns last year were first-time gun owners, of whom half were women, a fifth were black, and a fifth were Hispanic. In 2021, gun owners overall were 63% male, 73% were white, 10% were black, and 12% were Hispanic. Separately, the Thrace, a nonpartisan group that tracks gun sales, estimates that 2.3 million guns were purchased in January of this year alone. The group said sales, which had remained largely flat for the duration of the Trump presidency, jumped 64% in 2020. Still, the increases are relatively small compared to the 400 million guns estimated to already be in circulation, including at least 4 million AR-15s, commonly described as assault rifles. South Los Angeles City Council representative Marquise Harris-Dawson told the New York Times, "Americans are in an arms race with themselves," adding, "There was just as much a run on guns as on detergents and cleaners in the beginning of the pandemic." increased gun sales comes as Texas recently became the 20th state to pass legislation that no longer requires a permit to carry a concealed handgun. At the same time, a rash of mass shootings, often involving AR-15 weapons, have dominated headlines. According to the Gun Violence Archive, 67 mass shootings have taken place in May of this year. The most recent occurred when a gunman opened fire in Miami, Florida, killing two people and injuring 20 others. Authorities in Texas said recently they had arrested a man accused of plotting to carry out a mass shooting at a Walmart store, and a search of the suspect's home turned up firearms, ammunition, and materials officials described as radical ideology paraphernalia. Still, researchers are wary of connecting increased gun ownership with gun violence. The FBI reported a 25% rise in homicides last year that has continued into this, with an 18% increase over the first 3 months of 2021 across 37 cities, including rises of 36% in the city of Los Angeles and 23% in New York City. But criminologist Richard Rosenfeld at the University of Missouri told the New York Times that the focus on gun numbers is misplaced. Richard Rosenfeld said, "The critical issue is not simply the increase in the supply of guns, but in the nature of the weaponry that's being used in violent crime. And that has really changed."
Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, their once closely coordinated relationship is now fraying as a cascade of disagreements has emerged between them, especially over the past few months. As external factors such as the 2011 uprisings brought Saudi Arabia and the UAE together, changes in regional and global geopolitics are now putting their interests at odds, periodically turning them against each other. The Saudi-Emirati relationship went into overdrive amidst the 2011 protests that rocked political establishments across the Arab world. Their closer alliance was a serious attempt to build up a unified front against any revolutionary movement in the region. To some extent, it was this fear of revolution and those who fanned its flames that finally resulted in the blockade of Qatar in 2017. Spearheaded by Riyadh and Abu Dhabi, the blockade meant to dissuade Doha from supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, a movement considered by many as the main force behind what they call the Arab Spring. The rapid rise of young Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia and his close friendship with the ambitious Crown Prince of the UAE made the two countries take a more adventurous, aggressive path in the region.
We have to know that the relationship between Saudi Arabia, represented by MBS, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and Emirates, represented by MBZ or MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed, those countries' relationship are based on the friendship of their respective rulers. And now, after like a honeymoon, long honeymoon, this honeymoon is coming to an end.
The immediate result was a bloody campaign against the poorest country in the region, under the excuse of reinstating the fugitive president of Yemen. All these factors, along with the enmity with Iran, kept the two Arab powers close to each other for about 10 years. But now the so-called Arab Spring has largely passed, and revolutionary sentiment appears mostly on the margins of the internet than in street protest. As anti-state challenges began to fade, a split of opinions began to appear on how to deal with pro-revolutionary groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and, by extension, Qatar. In January 2021, Riyadh announced the end of the blockade on Qatar, a move Abu Dhabi didn't welcome warmly. The Emiratis have yet to restore a full-time ambassador to Doha. In Yemen, strategic realities have also begun to set in. At first, the Emiratis and the Saudis were equally committed to fighting with the Ansarullah movement. But as the war went on, Abu Dhabi decided that the war was more a Saudi problem and therefore became less willing to expend the troops and treasure on the campaign. The decision consequently led to a certain amount of bad blood between the two sides. Things could turn for the worse in Yemen, especially as the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council continues to seek secession from Yemen, which Saudi Arabia wants to keep unified. Meanwhile, the two countries' attempts to diversify their oil-dependent economies have triggered a kind of economic friction. In tourism, Saudi Arabia hopes to copy Dubai's luxury lure and, if possible, overtake it. With similar climates and attractions, Saudi Arabia and the UAE have found themselves in a fierce rivalry in attracting tourists. Mega projects such as Jeddah Tower and the futuristic town of Neom have been designed to lure businesses and workers away from the glitzy malls of Dubai. Saudi Arabia is also pursuing new transport and infrastructure projects, threatening well-established Emirati companies. Its new national airline, for instance, is striving to muscle out Dubai's Emirates airline market share. The Saudis are also growing ports along the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf, hoping to unseat Jebel Ali on the southern outskirts of Dubai, which acts as the logistical linchpin between Asia and Europe.
It's not new, but publicly now it's in the open. But before, no, it wasn't. It's not new. It's like started by differences like since the war in Yemen, and who is in the lead, who wants to be in the lead. And secondly, one sanction opposed on Qatar also, or the relations between Jebel Ali especially, or Emirates and trading with Iran. There were like so many differences between Emirates and Saudi Arabia, but now it comes to an open publicly.
In February 2021, Saudi Arabia warned it would terminate state contracts with businesses that didn't have their regional headquarters in the kingdom, a desperate act to force them move from the UAE.
This will weaken the Emirates' economy, and especially when Saudi Arabia asked the big international companies to come back from Emirates, and because Saudi Arabia is much wider and bigger, let's say, merchant for investors to invest. So this will, economic-wise, will bother Emirates. A lot.
A few months later, in July 2021, Riyadh imposed tariffs on goods produced in free zones or with Israeli involvement. policy decisions that directly affect the Free Zone heavy, Israel-friendly United Arab Emirates. A more overt attempt by Riyadh to limit the Emirates' gains from normalization with Israel. On the other hand, at OPEC, the Emiratis have been more willing to break with the Saudis to gain the production level they want, a sign of growing rift between the two sides.
Saudi Arabia is saying that by extending the oil production, the oil price will go down. And we need it to be stable. And that's why you have OPEC Plus, like the 22 countries is like with Saudi Arabia in this manner. But Emirates has another point of view. They said, okay, we lost so much like money and our economy is a little bit tight. So we need to extend our oil production, like increase our portion of oil production daily. But that will make the oil price, as according to Saudi opinion, will make the oil price go down again. This is the main problem, main issue. So it's also economic-wise, and it is related, especially when UAE is very related economy to the oil production. It's like more than 30% of its economy depends on oil production.
As the UAE-Saudi axis deteriorates, so has the hard line against Iran. Bin Salman's language in Iran has softened dramatically since his rise as the Saudi crown prince. Likewise, the UAE has been busy patching up with Iran. All in all, the growing divergence of interests between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi has created serious cracks in the thin layer of their strategic entente, as it used to be hailed. Although the two sides might continue to agree on some major strategic matters, Riyadh and Abu Dhabi are expected to chart different courses in the coming decade. In fact, overlapping economic competition and strategic differences have already marked an end to a decade of unprecedented alliance.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
the limelight.
The day after wind-driven flames from the Dixie Fire ripped through the Northern California town of Greensville, residents who had reluctantly left their homes behind sat at a picnic table under hazy skies in a parking lot about 25 miles away. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Livia Olbeck-Ripka and Annie Carrillo. The piece is titled, "We Lost Everything. Residents are left in shock by the Dixie Fire's destruction." After wind-driven flames from the Dixie Fire ripped through the Northern California town of Greenville, residents who had reluctantly left their homes behind sat at a picnic table under hazy skies in a parking lot about 25 miles away. "I knew our town was going up," said Teresa Clark, a 34-year-old, describing the moment she had decided to evacuate, watching the flames approach as the air got hotter and the chances for escaping grew slimmer. "That's when the sheriff pulled up and said, 'You guys need to leave,' she said. 'I was scared to death.'" Inside the nearby Paradise Grill Diner in Quincy, California, some Greenville residents spoke in disbelief about how quickly the flames had raged down the mountain towards their beloved community. "We lost everything," said Jose Garcia, a 34-year-old who sent his family away but stayed behind with his father, Juvenal Garcia, a 70-year-old, vainly chopping down trees to create firebreaks. "I tried to defend it to the last second," said the younger Mr. Garcia, who described realizing he had just minutes to get his three dogs in the truck and grab important family documents as the wildfire burnt closer and closer. "The fire just pushed me out," he said. The Garcias' houses were lost to the flames like so many other buildings in Greenville, a town of about 1,000 people that became but the latest California community to be devastated by wildfires that are growing faster and burning earlier in the season than anyone in the state has ever seen. "I don't think we'll rebuild," said Mr. Garcia, who also lost his taco restaurant. By Friday morning, 6th of August, the Dixie Fire, which sparked a little more than 3 weeks ago, had grown to nearly 433,000 acres of land, according to the authorities, becoming the third largest blaze in recorded California history, up from 6 the day before. It is now the largest wildfire in the United States this year, surpassing the Bootleg Fire in southern Oregon. Sheriff Todd Johns of Plumas County said at a community meeting on Thursday, 5th of August, that there were no reported injuries during Greenville's destruction, but that the authorities were still looking for four people who were unaccounted for. He estimated that the blaze had destroyed more than 100 homes in the area. "My heart is crushed by what has occurred there," said Sheriff Johns, a lifelong Greenville resident. Greenville's downtown had still had many buildings that dated back to the Gold Rush era of the mid-19th century. Fire officials estimate that 75% of the town's structures were lost to the blaze. "It looks like a bomb went off," said Ryan Meacher, a 37-year-old whose father's house in Greenville was one of many that burned down. "There is nothing left." Mr. Meacher said it was heartbreaking to think about what was lost. The library where he would pick up books and VHS tapes, the pizza place next door with an arcade. Also destroyed were a charter school and a Cy Hall Memorial Museum, which covered the history of Indian Valley, a verdant mountain valley whose inhabitants once depended on timber from the surrounding mountains, and where many residents still rely on cattle ranching. Jesse Isu, a 38-year-old, lives in nearby Taylorsville and evacuated south on Thursday with her husband. her three young children, and her parents, who did not know whether their Greenville home still stood. She said it had seemed like a movie as they prepared to leave with their Nigerian dwarf goats, an alarm blaring and wild wind sending a smoke plume with black center towards the area. Greenville is a wasteland, she said. It's just surreal. In the parking lot outside the Paradise Grill, other evacuees from towns near Greenville were camped out in trailers, waiting to see if their homes would suffer the same fate. Though she had lived through other wildfires, Sandy Paget, who had evacuated from North Arm, said this one was different. "We didn't have this wind," she said, adding that it was driving the wildfire to the point of being unfightable. Sandy Paget said that, as far as she knew, her town and home were still untouched, though others had remained in the town she and her partner had chosen to evacuate, she said, because it was not worth the risk. "There's a lot worse tragedies than losing your home," Sandy Paget said. "You can always rebuild." Dixie Fire exploded by more than 97,000 acres in just 24 hours, becoming the third largest wildfire on record in California by Friday, 6th of August. It had been only 6th on the list of blazes the day before. The fire, which leveled the town of Greenville in Northern California this week, also became the largest blaze in the United States this year, having burnt 432,813 acres of land by Friday morning, according to the New York Times wildfire tracker. It has destroyed at least 91 structures so far and is likely to grow, with only 35% of the fire contained. The Bootleg Fire in Oregon had previously been the largest wildfire in the nation this year, at 413,765 acres. That fire is 87% contained. Experts say that the Dixie Fire's dramatic growth fits into a trend of rapidly expanding wildfires fueled by severe drought conditions, driven in part by a warming climate. The number of wildfires has not gone up, but the amount of burnt area since the 1980s in California has actually doubled, more than doubled, said Robert Field, a researcher at Columbia University and NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Fire season has also started earlier in recent years. The Dixie Fire ignited on 13th of July, about 2 weeks before the state typically experiences its most intense wildfires. "We're approaching historical levels of wildfires that have not been seen at this explosive rate of growth in over 100 years," said Tim Jones, a public information officer for the agencies fighting the Dixie Fire. 7 of California's largest wildfires have occurred within the past year, the largest in the state's recorded history going back to 1932, because records before that are considered unreliable, burnt last August when a series of dry lightning strikes ignited multiple fires that merged to scorch over a million acres of land. "There's just that much more fuel on the landscape, and it's become more flammable because of climate change," said Dr. Field. Fire experts don't see much indication that conditions would improve anytime soon. California is seeing larger and more intense wildfires, putting those on the front lines at greater risk as they attempt to stop raging flames like those from the Dixie Fire that ripped through Greenville, California this week. "They're just spreading so fast and so hot, sometimes we feel like we're on our heels trying to play catch-up," said said Chris Aragon, a captain with California Fire, the state's fire agency. It's not the same behavior as the fires we were used to a decade or more ago. Of the 10 largest wildfires ever recorded in California, 6 were within the past 12 months. The Dixie Fire grew overnight to become the state's 3rd largest wildfire on record and the biggest so far this season. While most people flee from the flames, the approximately 7,500 firefighters at Cal Fire run towards them, sometimes inhaling smoky air, collapsing from dehydration, and working 96 hours straight. When Captain Aragon, a 36-year-old, worked as a seasonal firefighter more than a decade ago, most wildfires broke out between July and September, he said. The season was long if it ran through Halloween. The large swathes of the West dry out and burn, scientists say. Climate change is playing an increasing role in the earlier fire seasons, the deadly heat waves, and the lack of water. The record high temperatures that assaulted the Pacific Northwest in late June and early July, for instance, would have been all but impossible without climate change, according to a team of researchers who studied the deadly heat wave. Heat, drought, and fire are connected, and because human-caused emissions of heat-trapped gases have raised baseline temperatures nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit on average since 1900, heat waves, including those in western United States and western Canada, are becoming hotter and more frequent. The Southwest is getting hammered by climate change harder than almost any other part of the country, apart from perhaps coastal cities. Jonathan Overpeck, a climate scientist at the University of Michigan, recently told the New York Times. Jonathan Overpeck added, "And as bad as it might seem today, this is about as good as it's going to get if we don't get global warming under control."
Around the world with reporters.
Pakistan's president, foreign minister, and others joined this rally in support of the people of Kashmir. The rallies were held in Pakistan to mark the 2nd anniversary of India's, what Pakistan says, illegal move to revoke the special status of the disputed Kashmir region. India, on August 5, 2019, abrogated the Article 370 of the Indian Constitution that granted special status to the Jammu and Kashmir region. Pakistan rejected the move as a violation of